This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have got one sponsor for the show, that's Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite device management software for Macs and iOS devices. And we'll tell you more about those guys as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening.
How's it going?
Yeah, it's going pretty well. How are you?
Good. Tired. I'm off today. It's my last personal day of the year. We cannot take personal days in May, and so then they kind of don't make sense to take over the summer because we work a different schedule. So basically, you want to use all your personal days in April. And so we're recording on the 28th, so might as well take the day off.
Absolutely. Good job. So you're nice and fresh for the show.
No, well, I have been, it's springtime here in the southern U.S., so I'm doing landscaping because we bought our house last year in the end of May, so we kind of missed the season to plant stuff.
Right.
Because by the time we got in and got settled, it was blaring hot in June, and then we had a new sun in July, so trying to play catch up on landscaping.
Okay, good stuff. Interesting thing coming up for me, we're heading into exam time at our school, and one of the things that's kicking off, we're recording on Monday night this week, and on Wednesday we've got our first digital exam of the year. Most of the students do exams on paper, traditional exams on paper, but some of our kids who have additional needs of whatever kind will do their exams digitally. And that means different things at different times. Sometimes it means filling in sort of PDF forms for those exams where the candidates write on the paper with a pencil or pen. There's a PDF version where there's a box that's made up and you can type in the box. And other times it means using a kind of a word processor just to produce typed pages, and then you put that together with a flyleaf. So that's kicking off on Wednesday. And it's kind of an interesting technical challenge as well, because we do it with the iPad, but at the end of the day, you've got to print out what the pupils type, and then that gets sent away with the handwritten paper copies as well. So we have to basically build a network that's completely secure, that's firewalled off, and but still has access to a Wi-Fi printer so that we can print out the document at the end of the day. So there's been an interesting little challenge putting that together in our Aerohive system. So basically we made a new user profile, which is completely firewalled off from the internet. So any traffic to anything that's not on the subnet that we're using is completely dropped, just to keep that secure. But it's quite interesting. We debated whether or not we should just use normal iPads and put on gated access. But in fact, we've decided we're going to use completely white spare iPads for that instead, so that we know exactly what's on there and what can be accessed and what can't. So there's a whole procedure for doing that. It's pretty good.
Well, and that's, we've talked multiple times about the benefits, even in a smaller school, even if you've got a school that you just need two or three access points, overusing something like Aerohive or any enterprise grade vendor over something, the consumer grade, like, Apple's or D-Link or Netgear, even though, the Apple's, network works great and it's very fast, the ability to kind of do those, firewalled off networks where they can't access the internet, but they can still print, that's the kind of the secret sauce of an enterprise grade.
Yeah. We had, I'm trying to think last year, what was last year? Last May. Yeah, we had Aerohive last year, but I think at that point I didn't really know how to do enough of that stuff. So we sort of did it a slightly different way. We brought in some separate Wi-Fi equipment, built a separate network. Basically, we used our old Apple stuff and we just turned it on when we needed to print the thing. But this year we can do it through our existing network, and I know how to do that now, which is great. So fingers crossed for that. So it's super stressful, though. I think, the whole idea, that there's... Basically, what they've done is they've taken the paper exam and they've basically made it digital, but everything's exactly the same. So you're literally typing on the paper instead of writing on the paper, and all the same rules apply. So, if something goes wrong with the computer or whatever, then it's the opportunity to do the exam is sort of gone. So I find it super stressful, and the iPad's a reliable device, but you just never know what could happen. I don't enjoy running them at all.
No, we're in kind of that same boat where we did testing probably 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I didn't really talk about it because I have literally nothing to do with it. And we had one student that, like, the Friday before exams broke his arm on the playground. So when it came to the writing exam, he was going to type it. And because we were trying to figure out, you know, how did we, you know, setting up Word where there was no grammar or spell check. I think I had to disable the voice dictation in Mountain Lion, and then, you know, then you know, having to do the same thing, separate it off, get it online where it can print at the end of it. But then, you know, which again, to me, it feels like you should be turning that in digitally. The whole idea of printing something like that still blows my mind. But, you know, and to me, that's stressful enough. But then you think, like, imagine if you're a school of like 1,000 kids and the whole thing was digital, start to finish. How stressful would you be? I don't even know that you'd sleep the night before.
Oh, I wouldn't sleep for months after either, I don't think.
You would just, I would probably like reboot everything like 2 days before to kind of get it cleared out memory wise, but not, you don't want to reboot it like the day of in case something major broke. I don't know, like that's where like having some sort of like 3G, 4G failover, that kind of stuff stresses me out. Because even if your internet didn't go down, but like something messed up internally, like you had an access point break and you didn't have a spare or a switch went down, like that's the stuff you lose sleep over.
Yeah, that's all super, super, super stressful. I you know, the way that we do it is reasonably simple in the sense that at least there's no network component, in the sense that you can still complete the exam if the network goes down, and then we just have to figure out a way to print it. Probably we'd, I don't know, transfer it over USB to an iTunes machine and then print it with a USB cable from that or something. You know, it's going to be something like that. But imagine you had to do that where the network had to stay up for the whole duration of the exam with everybody pending on it, and, you know, well, super difficult.
If you're in those situations, that's when you're probably likely to, on your firewall, pay for high availability, where you have a failover unit. And on your switching, you probably have the same thing, where you probably have some sort of mechanism where if a switch fails, if you know, it's another one takes over. Because it all depends on, you know, how, you know, we can realistically, like, we could be down for a day on most days, and it would be slightly inconvenient, but we could survive. I mean, most teachers get email on their smartphones. You have a data connection. But in those situations, like, you just can't go down. And obviously, if you work in enterprise America and you manage, you know, websites for, you know, if you manage Amazon's website, like, you're in charge of things like that, or you run mail servers for, you know, like, I can't imagine working in IT and healthcare. You know, if I have a computer that doesn't roam, that's not a big deal. But, like, if a doctor has a computer that doesn't roam, that's a bigger deal. And so those kind of environments, I don't know that I would function well in.
Yeah. To give you an idea, the course that I taught this year called Admin in IT had a completely different approach to this. And as far as I know, this is kind of the first time this has sort of been done, where instead of there being, like, a two-hour slot in the year where you do all your work, what happens is that we were given the assignment paper and the students had to complete all the tasks in class on the computer. And then when they were done, we sort of packaged it all up and sent it away. But the thing was that there was flexibility about sort of when you did that. So you could either do it in 4 1-hour slots or one whole 4-hour session or different things. And that means that you're in a situation where, say something does go wrong, you can say, right, well, cancel this 1-hour session, we'll reschedule that for another time, and we've got to do it all before a certain date, like the 24th of April or something like that. So that's a different way of doing it. There's not that many courses are assessed that way, but I think it's a wee bit of a toe in the water for the future, because ultimately this is all going to be digital, right? Because eventually, you know, I mean, we've talked about this before, that the form of assessment when you go into an exam room and write by hand on paper from your memory isn't really well aligned with the kind of teaching that we do. So we're going to have to solve this problem one way or another.
Yes. Yes. Stressful times. It's always fun. You know, it's, you know, I don't know a good analogy. You have this big rush of stress when it comes to exam time, and then it's, you kind of just coast to the end of the year and you hopefully land that plane.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, Wednesday will be the first one, and once we get the first one done, we'll take it from there. You know, I think that'll be a settler for everybody that we got through it and it worked fine. But man, do not enjoy these days at all.
No. Before we move on to our topic, let's thank our sponsor for this week. The fine folks at Jamp Software, they provide IT staff with enterprise tools to power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in education organizations. They have a great tool called Casper Focus that allows teachers, not the IT staff, but the teachers to control basically what's going on students' iPads, so directly from their iPad. So again, they're not having to work with IT staff or administration. They're taking control of the classroom. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app using the Gadget Access API that we mentioned earlier. They can select a specific Apple TV. They can choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. Thanks for the fine folks at Jamf for sponsoring the show this week. You know, I was listening to the Mac power users from this week, and they were talking about Mac OS X Server and talking about Profile Manager, and they actually mentioned some of the things we do, and Casper got brought up as one of the kind of tools that, you know, Profile Manager can do a lot, but when you're ready to take that next step with things like managed distribution and things like that, you really want to take a look at a dedicated tool like the Casper Suite from Jamf.
Most definitely, yeah. There was just an update today, actually, Casper 931, which brings back quite a few nice little search features around about device inventory and things like that, so you can now search a little bit more fluidly than you could before. 9.0, when we went to Casper 9, it kind of took away some of the flexibility of searching, and that's all come back now, so I look forward to upgrading to that in the near future. Not this week.
Yeah, I was going to say not this week. What's the upgrade process like for Casper? Is it kind of like a one-click?
It's pretty straightforward. We host our Casper on an Amazon EC2 server. So basically what I'll do is you log into your Jamf Nation account, which is their kind of user forum, and integrated with that is like the availability for your downloads. So you go in there, download the latest thing, and then I'll just unzip it on my Mac and SCP to my server. Like there's a binary file, which is the installer. It's essentially some kind of Linux shell script or whatever. And then you just shell into the server, run that. Make a backup of your database first, obviously, and then run the new installer, reboot the machine, and you're done. No, not even reboot the machine, but reboot the Tomcat instance that runs it. So it's pretty straightforward, and has been super reliable.
How, you know, we mentioned this probably getting close to a year ago, but how has your monthly cost from Amazon been?
Gone down, yep. So I think we're probably paying about, I mean, I'm doing it through my own Amazon account at the moment, so it's kind of, it's mixed in with all the stuff I've got on S3 and everything, but my total Amazon bill is about $40 a month, including the cost of running that EC2 machine.
That's not bad, especially if that's not all it was, because I know it spiked, you know, kind of day one last year, and I know you wonder, will you see that again this year, you know, if new students are coming in and getting new apps and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the nice thing about being on EC2 is that you can bump up to a huge machine for those 4 days where you're really busy and then bump back down to the size you need for the steady state. The other thing I was going to say about that was that, what was the other thing I was going to say about it? Amazon EC2, da-da-da-da-da. No, I just had a complete mental blank about what I was going to say about that. But when Casper 9.0 came out, the communication between the web app and the database was quite heavy and quite CPU intensive. And I think it was in 9.2 or maybe 9.1. They put in a number of efficiency improvements that really brought down the minimum amount of CPU you could apply to have your GSS running properly. So that optimization that came along a little bit after we started, I think it was maybe sort of October, November time, maybe a wee bit later. That allowed us to actually step down one level in EC2 down to the one just above micro. I think it's called small. So that saved some money too.
You know, it's worth mentioning that it's like the longest sponsor read ever. But, you know, if you want to, you know, they're kind of, I guess you could say there's three ways to deploy Casper Suite. You could deploy it on your, you know, on site, on a Mac, you know, Windows and Linux machine, anything pretty much will run Jamf. You could do something like Amazon EC2, but if you really just kind of want a turnkey approach, they do have a hosted option as well. Now, again, you know, it's slightly more to have them host it, but if you don't want to fool with something on site and you don't want to deal with EC2, there is kind of that third option, which is JSS hosted.
Yeah, that's pretty new. That wasn't actually available to me this time last year. That came along, I think, actually in 2014 at some point. So I haven't even looked at that yet, but maybe one day I'll move to that.
Yeah, I mean, depending, you know, with all cloud services, you kind of get that pendulum where like it doesn't make sense to even consider it. But then you've got, yep. you know, for our size deployment or your size deployment, it's just so, you know, if you just want something that's dead simple, that seems to be the way to go. You know, you don't have to worry about dealing with backing up things and, you know, upgrades. It just kind of works.
Yeah. Although I have to say that, you know, of all the things I've ever administered on a server, then I think Casper's got to be one of the best packaged things that I've ever used. You know, in terms of something that you put on a Linux machine, it's really pretty straightforward and pretty slick. I mean, their main deployment target is OS X server. So that's kind of like the one you see when you see the list of downloads. OS X server is kind of the highlighted one, but it's then they have this section called downloads for other platforms, and that's where you get the Linux and the Windows and so on. So it does work on all of those, but I think they sort of primarily expect people to be running it on OS X server, which we're not at the moment, but I might look into possibly migrating, because as we move over to managed distribution, my Apple configurator machine is going to become slightly redundant. That's a Mac Pro. It's a 2010 Mac Pro, so it's a pretty beefy machine, and I think I might try and get a little more value out of that by just putting our GSS on that. That'll be a job.
Yeah, that'll be fun. That'll be a fun week. Please let it work now. So topic, you know, we're continuing with our deployment 2014 series, and you know, we're actually getting, we're over two-thirds of the way done, because I believe, let's see, this is part 11. So we have 15 weeks, and this is week 11. So we're actually getting pretty close to the end. And this week, we're talking about something that we hope we never have to deal with, disaster recovery and damage procedures.
But you will have to deal with it.
Yes. No, I think the thing, you know, I guess if you only remember one thing from this show, is don't look at the headlines for, you know, schools that say, oh, the iPad, it's fragile, it breaks. And, you know, on this last week's ATP, the Accidental Tech podcast, John Syracuse was talking about, they were talking about iPad upgrade cycles. And he was saying that, like, for a piece of glass, this thing's pretty durable. You can go through, you know, hands of grimy kids year after year, and it kind of just survives. So even though the iPad's a piece of glass, like, I would say it's very durable. And I think your damage percentage will be a lot less than, like, I think people would think. Like, the iPad is durable, again, as long as you take care of it and aren't dropping it off the top of a building. Like, it's more durable than you think.
Yeah, I think the ATP episode you mentioned, I mean, let's just put it out there that three people independently emailed me to say that I shouldn't listen to that episode without some sedatives, because some of the things that were being said about iPads on that show were not exactly in line with most people's understanding of the topic. But I think the thing, particularly in education, is something that we fought against years ago and continue to fight against all the time, is this highly, you know, it's sort of obviously intuitive, right, that children will break pieces of glass. But in fact, it's not really borne out by the evidence. I mean, yes, children will break them at times. You know, adults break them too, right? But then children break loads of other things as well. Children break chairs. They break, you know, they break their own arms, like you mentioned earlier. You know, they drop scientific equipment off the bench. They knock it with their elbow. They accidentally tear books. They drop them in puddles and so on. And obviously the point that is implicitly being made is that the iPad is much more expensive than all these things. Therefore, it's a disaster. But in fact, I think it certainly hasn't been my experience over the course of nearly 4 years now that you're just constantly dealing with breaks. But I think the argument about this, Bradley, is more subtle than just the iPad doesn't break, because it does break. But under what circumstances does it break, and how can you sort of mitigate the risk of that happening, right? So I think the first section we want to talk about is prevention is better than cure. And let's go back to our favorite topic.
Yeah, good old cases. Now, you know, you want to choose a good case. And when we say good case, I'm not saying you need to get the Griffin Survivor case for your entire deployment. Not saying that.
You're not going to Iraq with this iPad.
Exactly. Yep. And you're probably not dropping it off a building for testing, more than likely.
Yeah.
And I'll say this. I have, let's see, I manage 81 iPads and then roughly probably 100 to 120 max, depending on who you count. I have had drastically more drops, spills, vomiting, dings, and all of the above on Macs than I have iPads. I have not had an iPad broken. I had one lost last week for 3 days, but we did find it. Mm-hmm. But I've not had an iPad broken, and I have a $3 case on every one of them. So good case does not mean expensive. It means a good case.
Yeah. And I think we can refer to episodes past in terms of exactly what we mean by a good case. But I think I would back you up on that point, Bradley, that a good case doesn't mean one that you spent $70 per device on. Because at that point, it doesn't make sense. You know, you've got to work this out with a very cold and logical head on you, that there's a certain cost to an iPad being broken, right? And that cost is, worst case scenario, whatever Apple's standard out of warranty charges. And in the UK, for a Retina iPad, it is quite expensive. It's about £240. For previous iPads, it was under £200. But the point is, you know, if you're going to spend, say, £100 on putting a case on every device in order to save £250 in the odd instance where one gets broken, you're throwing money away. Better to bank that money and keep it for the day when somebody does break it.
You know, when we lost that iPad last week, you know, people were like really upset. You know, the teacher's assistants, they were stressed out, constantly emailing me, calling me, has the iPad shown up yet? I said, no. But, you know, but the thing is, I told them, we have had iPads in our school since 2010. We have never had one broken. We have never had one lost. If we lose one, does it stink? Sure. We'll just replace it. It's just like if a desk is broken, like you mentioned, or if a textbook gets dropped in a puddle. It's just the cost of doing business. And I think, you know, I've done a whole lot more work on Macs. Now, again, we don't put any cases on our Macs, but, you know, I've done a whole lot more work on student Macs, again, due to vomiting and things like that, and I have iPads. So if I have to replace one every 4 years, I'm okay with that. One thing I see with the iPad for, you know, if you kind of want to look at that aspect, is the battery stops charging, you know, it being as reliable over time as it is like a damage issue. There are plenty more iPads that I have. I'd love to replace the battery if it was feasible. We just don't have the issue with drops and, you know, breaking glass.
Yeah, I mean, I think the truth is that people do drop your iPads all the time and you just don't know about it because it survives. And I think that, to me, and this comes from a conversation I had with somebody I know who's a researcher in educational technology, and he said to me that he believes that he can grade the quality of leadership in a school by the number of devices that they break. I thought that was very interesting. I'm not saying that it's necessarily proven or true or fully correlated or anything like that, but it was interesting that he even made that observation. And I think, and it sort of intuitively makes sense based on what I've seen happen as well, that schools where the deployment is led and managed and built into a culture of respect and purpose and use for the device, those deployments usually see many, many fewer breakages than ad hoc deployments that aren't really built into the life of the school. But deployments that are properly led and properly managed really do seem to achieve very low breakage rates. And I want to roughly put that number at about 1-2% per year. If you've got the culture right, that's about the number you should be seeing. If you're seeing 20, 30, 40% per year, you don't have a case problem. You don't have a device problem. You've got a cultural problem. And it doesn't matter what device you buy. If you could buy laptops, and you would see people pinging the keys off those laptops, because the problem is that you don't have a culture of respect for the school equipment in there. It's not just about the device or about the defense that you put on it.
Right, because even if on those situations, even if you put a Griffin Survivor case, you'll have them, they get quote-unquote lost. They get stolen. They go missing.
Yeah.
You know.
Or you get the seatbelt effect, where because it looks like it can take anything, people try to see just how much it can take. And that's another risk of using that kind of case, is because it looks super safe, people just start to treat it with ridiculous abandon. And the same thing can happen, and this is something that I often recommend when I'm talking to schools who are planning this kind of thing, is don't make a big song and dance to the pupils about how much insurance you've got. Because this, you get the same effect, you get the seatbelt effect again, where if you go, all risks are covered, everything's insured, you'll always have a device, it'll always be fixed, then guess what happens? Nobody cares, right? You just throw it down, it's insured, doesn't matter, I'll just get a replacement, right? And suddenly your insurance premium shoots up in year two, and then you're looking at a much higher cost. There's a school, I can't remember exactly where it was, somewhere down south, I think, in England, where they were seeing breakage rates of about 50%. So they did this whole big deployment, and then the newspaper story was half of iPads broken at school. And what they said was, you know, basically we got the wrong case. In that instance, they just got the wrong case, and they replaced the entire school's cases, and then they went down to about 2% per year. Other places I've heard of and colleagues have been to, you know, we've seen kids just completely abusing devices because the school made such a big deal about how much insurance they've got. So I think this sort of damage and repair thing isn't just about the device, and it's not just about the defense, but it's also about the culture that you build your deployment into as well.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree with that. I took the case off my iPhone a few months ago, and is it perfect? No. But it still works. It's got a few nicks on it. The screen still looks great. I've dropped it once or twice, and then thankfully hasn't cracked. And so when you look at your iPads and you look at trying to protect them, you know, you're not going to keep it in pristine condition like the day it came out of the box. Your textbooks don't stay that way. Any aspect of your school, you know, they show wear and tear over time. So when we say, you know, 1 to 2% breakage rate a year, it isn't going to be that they look new in box or they look in mint condition. No. They're going to show wear and tear, and that's okay. You may even have some scratches on the screen, and that's okay, because when you know, I think you'll notice even if you have a surface scratch on the glass, when you hit the power button, you don't even see it.
Yeah. I would actually go further than that, Bradley. I would argue that if you don't see wear and tear in your devices, you haven't done it right. That if your devices don't look like the Millennium Falcon after 3 years, then you haven't used them enough. Simple as that.
Yeah,
they've sat in a cart.
Yeah, if you're selling them to Gazelle at the end of your deployment and you put flawless, like you missed it. Like it should be like it works. It should be the lowest end.
Yeah. Dented, scratched, all that stuff, but absolutely used. I mean, that was certainly how our iPads went away at the end of last summer. You know, I took every one of them out of the case. They were filthy. Some of them were dented on the back. They were worn. They had, you know, slight bends in the case in some instances, you know, but they all still worked, and they, you know, they had been used every hour of every day of all the school years that we had them. And that's exactly what I want to see. And I certainly regard, you know, pristine iPads at the end of 3 years as a failure on my part. Okay. So, you know, let's dig into the precise detail of this, right? In terms of what are you going to do and what are you going to plan for and what are you going to think about? I want to throw out some sort of concepts about this, Bradley, before we get into this, because we'll refer to them again, right? So there's three ideas about failure and disaster recovery. The first is the idea of mean time between failures, and that is the sort of average length of time that your devices were operational before you had a failure. Now, the way this is often talked about is it's talked about in terms of a singular system which can run for a while and then fail. And how long does this system work before it fails? Now, a one-to-one iPad deployment is a distributed system, right? So if one person's iPad fails, that doesn't mean everybody's iPad has failed, right? So I'm kind of abusing that term a little bit, but the idea being that how long will you go before somebody damages their iPad in a way that requires intervention? And I don't know if you have any numbers in your deployment. I actually looked it up just before the show for us. And so for our first 3 years, our mean time between failures was 75 days over 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I was pretty pleased with that. And the numbers actually, the overall number is quite interesting, because I don't know if you've heard of the idea of the bathtub model of deployment, or not deployment, of device failure. the idea being that if you draw a graph, then over time, from left to right, it looks like a bathtub section, where it's high at the beginning, very low in the middle, and then it increases towards the end of a device's life. And that's exactly what we saw in those 3 years, was that the majority of those failures are either in the first 4 months of a three-year deployment, or they're in the last 3 months. And we have long chunks of time, multiple hundreds of days in the middle, where nothing happened. So we got, and remember, we were getting some of the first iPads off the boat in 2010, you know, back when there were, you know, yield issues and quality issues on the production line that there really aren't today. We haven't seen that in our second deployment the same way. But when we had six or seven failures in the first 4 months, you know, very, very quiet period of long running in the middle of our deployment. And then as devices got older and had been used and switched on hundreds of thousands of times, we started to see failures of mostly of switchgear, actually. So the early failures were more about the screen. So not that they would crack, but that the LCD would actually give up, or the digitizer would give up or something like that. Whereas in the later failures, they were mostly about the power button doesn't work or the home button doesn't work anymore. And that was just pure wear and tear on those devices, as much as it was purely manufacturing issues in the early devices. So that mean time between failures is really important. So, because that will determine a lot about what you do in terms of spares and a little while. So we made 75 days in our mean time between failure over the course of 3 years in our first deployment. The second figure is the mean time to recovery. Okay, so if you think about this from the point of view of an individual pupil, this is the average time it takes you to take their device out of service and provide them with a new working device. Okay, now obviously you're going to carry spares to make your deployment work. And the question about how long it takes you to do that, there's various things in your deployment that will impact how much time that takes, and we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. But the mean time to recovery can be very quick with iOS devices. It can be on the order of, I want to say, maybe 2 to 4 hours, maybe a little bit less, a little bit more, depending on how much data has to be transferred on and off the device.
Well, and I think, you know, it all depends on what you're doing. You know, that number doesn't have to be 1 hour. It doesn't have to be 4 hours, depending on how you're using the iPads. You know, it would be, you know, if you, they're only used in the mornings, and for whatever reason, not used in the afternoons, you could have even like 24 hours. This will all depend on school to school on what you need to kind of shoot for.
Yes, exactly. But I think the more embedded you get into a full school one-to-one deployment, the shorter that number has to get. And there's a floor to how low it can get, right? There's the time taken to transfer data over USB or up and down to iCloud is going to be a factor there. So it's not like you can turn it. You could spend a lot more money and make it 5 minutes. That's not technically possible based on what's available right now. But you know, if you don't carry spares, for example, the point is that that number will be very much higher because you have to take the device, go to the store or whatever, come back and then set it up again. So mean time to recovery, the way I think about that is from the point of view of the student. How long are they without a device and therefore their education be interrupted before you can get them back up and running again? And the last one, and this is critical, this is a critical number, is your mean time to repair. Okay, so that's for any particular failed device. How long on average does it take you to get a new working device? Now, obviously, with an iPad, it's usually a swap-in and a swap-out situation rather than a component being repaired or something like that. But your mean time to repair is really important because that is one of the factors that determines how many spares you need to have. You get a good figure for your mean time to repair, Bradley?
Depending on, you know, if it was a glass being broken, mm-hmm. That would probably be a, you know, that... I don't know. Depending on what we are doing, I might try to get that glass, you know, repaired through like a third party. Mm-hmm. But if I had something under warranty, I would just drive it up to the local Mac Authority and they could swap it out. Again, this all depends on what you're doing, what device you're fixing. You know, if it's a yeah. Mac, then you know the kicker with a Mac is unless you have parts on the shelf, it's going to be 24 hours because you got to get that part sent in. You know, but again, if you're taking it to the local Apple store to be repaired or a local reseller, there's going to be a lot of variables there. And it depends on what's being fixed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Mac situation is very much different to the iOS situation, because for almost all repairs on iOS devices, you're basically swapping the whole unit for another one, right? But for the Mac, you could be looking at ordering in a logic board for a 2010 MacBook Air or a Retina display or something like that, and that could be 24 hours or more.
Well, and I think even in the Mac situation, and like, you know, for our deployments, I've got spares on the shelf. And so if a teacher had an issue that was going to require me to take, you know, have to order a part, I would just migrate his or her data to another machine, hand it to her, and they're off and racing, and likely would never even give them the repaired computer back. And you would just repair the computer and it would just become a spare.
Yeah,
and that's the benefit of the spares is you can just, you know, the repair is almost secondary. It's okay, let's get you back up and running first, and we'll deal with what it takes to fix later.
Yeah, I think that's one of the sort of essential techniques, particularly when you're doing a one-to-one deployment, you know, as you are with your teachers there, that you have to get that mean time to recovery as low as you can, and that involves carrying spares. Now, what happens after that, you know, the mean time to repair doesn't actually impact the user anymore because they're back and running with a working machine. But what that does is it impacts your spare inventory, right? You're down a spare at that point. And you have to think, well, how many more failures am I going to get before I can get that spare fixed?
Well, and if you're repairing Macs through Apple's authorized portal, you're actually graded on how quickly from the time you take a computer in to how quickly the parts come in versus how quickly you close the repair. Obviously, this is kind of set up for authorized resellers, and they're wanting to get computers back to customers as quickly as possible. Yeah. But I still get graded on that, and our payouts on our, you know, like when we fix something under warranty, we actually get paid from Apple on that. Our payouts are based on how quickly we close it, you know, kind of historically. They, you know, they kind of can raise your payout percentage on time. But yeah, I think the key to remember here is get the user back up and running, and then deal with it. You know, like even in our portable MacBook Air lab, we've kind of oversubscribed the number we would need, and we have probably three more in there than our biggest classroom. So even if I had two or three down at one time, every student could still have a computer when it's, you know, when their class comes around.
So it's an issue to do with, I suppose also one of the things that they're gathering there, Bradley, is how repairable are these machines? You know, is there something in the design of this machine that's causing everybody to take longer to repair it than otherwise? That's another piece of data that they're probably gathering through that dashboard. So the question always comes up, right? How many spares do you need? And always a tricky one to just exactly measure. Particularly, it's hard if you are a school who have not got much experience in managing large deployments of equipment, or certainly not large deployments of this kind of equipment as well. So if you're going one-to-one iOS and you have never handled these machines before, you don't really know what kind of damage rate to expect. You don't have all the factors in this equation, but one of the critical things we'll talk about later is that you must record this information for the future. But let's kind of lay it out, right? If your mean time between failures is 10 days, right? So every 10 days you're faced with another device that's possibly broken and needs to be fixed. If your mean time to repair is 1 day, then you can just live with one spare, right? Because it takes you a day to replace it, and you've got basically a 10-day window before on average, you're going to get another repair to do. But if your mean time between failures is 10 days and your mean time to repair is 30 days, then you're going to need multiple spares, 3 spares in that case, maybe 4, because, you know, if it takes a month to get a device back, and this is likely to be the case for some schools, particularly schools in places like Africa, where, you know, they don't have a very well-developed infrastructure of people to repair devices necessarily. Sometimes I've dealt with some schools where they had to, they basically had to FedEx the machines back to the US to get them fixed properly. And that's obviously a long turnaround, 30, 40 days. So they need to have a lot of spares on site because there's a high probability that they will see another device to be repaired before the first one's back. So they need to have 3, 4, 5 spares on site. So you can sort of work it out by dividing your mean time to repair by your mean time between failures and sort of work that out as your number of spares overall. Problem is your failure rate is probably not constant over the course of the whole deployment. Sometimes you'll be really busy, beginning and end of the deployment. Other times you'll be really quiet. But I think at that level, that's kind of a wee bit of the cost of doing business at that point.
Well, and again, like we've always said, the worst deployment, the most expensive one, is the one that doesn't work. So you don't want, you know, you don't want to tell, have to tell a student, hey, you're not going to have an iPad for a week because we have to send this off to be repaired. That's terrible. And it's just not feasible. And so you need to consider kind of the oversubscription model of having spares as just a cost of deployment and cost of doing it.
Yeah. School not so far from here, which did a one-to-one Android deployment for a year, they saw very, very high failure rates in their devices. And it wasn't actually damage rates, it was actual device failure rates. But they were faced with a very, very high mean time to repair. I think they were Toshiba devices, and they were, I'm doing this from memory, so forgive me if the numbers are not exactly accurate, but it was something like 60 days turnaround time on a broken device, which was very, very disruptive to what they were trying to do. And really, it didn't make the deployment a failure, but it certainly influenced their decision later on to change platforms again. So something to be aware of. And of course, this does tie back a little bit, Bradley, to the conversation about what device do you go for, right? Because I think one of my kind of arguments against going for Android devices has often been that you really don't know the provenance of these devices. Because there's such a turnover in the models, and there's actually, you know, and certainly in the tablet space, if not in the phone space, in the tablet space, there's not a huge amount of knowledge about how good or otherwise these devices are when they really get into the field. That you are taking a reasonable risk in terms of knowing, you know, for some unknown Android device, you don't really know what the mean time between failures is going to be for that device. And in large part, unless you're signing a service level agreement contract with some reseller, you probably don't know what the mean time to repair is going to be for that device either. You know.
Well, and obviously, I would dare say there are more iOS deployments in the world than there are Android deployments in the world. And if you look at, so if you take away all of the education deployments, all the business deployments, a lot of iPads are just sitting around the house waiting to be used. And the same thing for Nexus 7s, Nexus 10s, the Samsung tablets. And so they're not seeing, you know, there's a difference in usage when it's like kind of like your home computer that you read the web on at night versus when it's a major productivity machine day to day. Just as, you know, computers that are used at work probably die quicker. And, you know, people say, well, you know, people say, like, why do we have to replace our Macs and iPads every 3 years at our school? I mean, don't we buy on the Mercedes, the top of the line? And we'll say, yeah, but you know, even if you buy a Kia or if you buy a BMW or Mercedes, once they get to 300,000 miles, it's time to replace it. It doesn't matter what you paid for it. Like, you've put the miles on the car at that point. Yeah. The battery's worn out. It's just seen better days.
Mm-hmm. So those are some of the actual numbers that you can apply to these things. And it's certainly worth asking people who you maybe know who have done large-scale deployments, what kind of numbers were you seeing in this? And it's a question to ask of your reseller as well. If your reseller's proposing to get involved in your in repairs for you or handle repairs for you, what kind of mean time to repair can we expect from your service? Is it going to be a 24-hour swap-out or is it going to be 3 weeks? And then actually holding them to whatever it is they say as well. So this touches on more than just how many extras do we buy, but also may touch on, well, what device do we buy in the first place, and also who do we buy it from as well. So one of the nice things about Apple, and I think it's something that people don't factor into a discussion about the cost of iOS devices versus other devices, is the fact that if you happen to live near an Apple store, you just dropped your mean time to repair down to a couple hours. That's worth something as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And
because it means you don't have to carry so many spares. Right?
Well, you know, that's what I was kind of, you know, as much as I love Aerohive, that was one thing I told them that they should do, is that your local VARs should all have kind of an inventory that they can pull from for swaps. Mm-hmm. We had a school near us that had a firmware update that kind of, for whatever reason, took out a couple of their APs. Well, they have to, you know, they get them overnighted from California. But wouldn't it be nice if you could just drive up to the local reseller, hand them over, and they hand you three new ones, and you're ready to go?
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like that would be nice. And in a situation, again, if you had testing the next day, it would be nice just to go and have them in place. Again, you shouldn't be doing firmware updates the day before testing, but again, things certainly happen. If you had a power surge that knocked them out, it's just always nice to be able to drive somewhere and get it and drive back to school and get it fixed.
Yeah, I mean, having that facility nearby, and we've got two Apple stores within 40 minutes drive of our school, and you know, I've often thought, you know, should I get certified as an Apple repair technician or something? And we toyed with that a number of years ago when we were doing Macs, but it's never made sense. Now, because we have these Apple stores so close, it will never make sense for me to be a certified technician for our devices when I can just get in my car, drive 20 to 25 minutes in either direction and make it somebody else's problem. Well, sit with a coffee while they deal with it.
And even on the iOS side, you know, I kind of have their iOS qualification certification. But all that really is being able to tell if something's covered by warranty or not. I mean, that's, you know, you're not buying, you know, you're not really buying parts for the iPad. And I know they've done that a little bit more on the iPhone where you can swap out, you know, the camera sensor and things. And, but you do on the iOS side, these things are so tiny and so compact. It just, to me, I'm just wondering the whole viability of the on-site repair long term. And is it not better just to let Apple to deal with, you know, swapping it out?
Yeah. So in terms of the sort of, you know, when somebody does present themselves to you with a broken iPad, you know, what are you going to do with it? Obviously, like backing up these devices is something that we have to think about a little bit. And how you deal with that depends a little bit on whether you're doing what they call the institutional model, where you deploy apps through Apple Configurator and deal with it over USB, or through a personal model with iCloud. And what we do for our institutional model, and this is probably similar to what you do, Bradley, is we connect our devices back to our Apple Configurator machine. But what I do in there is I actually use iTunes to take a backup. I don't back it up through Apple Configurator every time I see it, because if I the issue is that basically the iTunes backups are incremental and they overwrite the previous backup. So it's always like one times the amount of data on the disk, whereas Apple Configurator backups are actually not incremental. They're standalone, which means that every time I see, you know, 15 devices, I'm going to take 15 backups. And that eats space on the disk and it eats time as well. So I use iTunes to take an incremental backup of every device that I see during their maintenance period. So it's about once a week to once a fortnight, I'll take a backup of those devices.
Well, and I know a lot of schools, when they get a machine for Configurator, a device doesn't exist now, but the 64 gig MacBook Air, that was kind of like the number one Configurator machine because it was the cheapest. Well, yeah, 64 gig MacBook Air is going to get filled up real quick.
Yeah, it's not going to take a lot of backups for a 32 gig iPad. The machine that we do that with is a Mac Pro with something like 6 or 8 terabytes of disk inside it. That's more than we need. You know, a lot of that's there for redundancy. That used to be our OS X server machine, so it was way overpowered for that task. Do not go and spec that machine just to run Apple Configurator. But that's what we do for institutional model. And then once you resupervise a new device, you can actually restore it in iTunes, reinstall the apps through Configurator, and you're back up and running with the same setup. With the personal model for our secondary kids, what we do is when we have them make an Apple ID, we turn on iCloud backup for them. And this can get a little bit tricky and awkward in terms of, because obviously, you know, everybody's running on 5 gigs of free iCloud backup space, and we'll not go down the rabbit hole of complaining about that, even though we probably should, because it is. But essentially what it does is the lack of size and space on iCloud backups that come for free, basically what it does is it eats into your mean time to recovery. Because, you know, if I'm presented with a pupil who's got a 32 gig iPad with 20 gigs worth of stuff on it, I've got to figure out somehow how I'm going to get that data backed up and then restored. And in some cases I can do it quite simply because most of their data is either like big apps, few games or whatever, or, you know, their camera rolls filled with stuff that's unimportant now, and we can slim that down and then we can do it. But the problem is you've got to sort of sit there with the student and go, well, what can I delete? What can I not delete? Whereas if, you know, you could at least have a 32 gig iCloud backup, you could just blow everything back up to iCloud and then restore it. That works fine. It's just a matter of sizing at this point, and it's a pain.
I would love to see, if we're not going to get more iCloud space for free, I would love to see the option to either somehow add storage to your MDM provider and back up to some sort of hosted space with your MDM vendor, yep. or we could back up to something on site. Because, like you said, the camera roll, if you've got apps like iMovie that are trying to back that up, you're going to fill that up quickly. And I've even seen, depending on if your school has iMessage turned on or off, I saw a teacher's iPhone last week that had 5 gigs of iMessages, 5 gigs of iMessages. And
the, too many animated GIFs.
Yeah, well, it's like 3 years worth of messages that all have pictures in them. Mm-hmm. And so there's just kind of this problem as we use these devices more and more that 5 gigs really just isn't enough.
I have seen, and this is a public document. This is not an internal secret that I'm giving away here. This public document. But if you look at Apple's tender response to the state of Maine's call for tenders on their latest one-to-one deployment, the one that actually HP won for reasons other than technology, I think. What's in there? There's actually a line in there that says Apple proposes to, for this money, provide everybody with an iPad of whatever size, plus for every student's Apple ID, 15 gigabytes of iCloud backup space. So Apple does at some level have the capacity to credit students with additional iCloud backup space, because that was part of their offering to the state of Maine, was that if you take these iPads, we will throw in 15 gigs for every account. So that's something that in future, maybe it's going to be, if your device is in the device enrollment program, whatever Apple ID is functional on that device gets 15 gigs. I've heard nothing about that. I'm not saying that's not a rumor I've heard. It's just something I know that Apple have publicly offered, because those are public documents. They're not secret documents. They're you can find them on the web. They do have the capacity to do that for very large deployments to talk about, if your criteria say the vendor must provide enough backup space for these devices, that's one way they can do that, is to credit the student's Apple IDs with iCloud space.
Well, and yeah, depending on the size of your deployment, it's one of the things you're buying yourself. You may pay more for that up front, but you're saving yourself fiddling time later.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the nightmare scenario in this is if you, like, say somebody dropped their iPad in a puddle and the device was completely non-operational, then you would, apart from maybe plugging it in over a cable, you would have to somehow take a full backup of that device and then restore that full backup without being able to do any manipulation of the data on the device itself. That's kind of difficult. But I reckon it can be done. You could probably do that through Apple Configurator, just pull a whole backup from the device and then restore that whole backup again. But again, it's pain, and it's stuff that I haven't really experimented that much with, because up till now, all my disaster recovery stuff has been done with a full iCloud backup and restore.
Hoping this is addressed in iOS 8, but not holding my breath.
The list of things that you and I are hoping is addressed in iOS 8, Bradley, would choke a horse.
Yes.
Yeah, we're pinning all our hopes in iOS 8. Pretty much like we have for every preview iOS release as well.
Very true.
Yep. So a couple of other just sort of small pointers to go along with this, right? We've already obviously talked about getting the pupil back up and running is obviously the number one priority, because the longer that device is out of action, the longer their education is impacted. So replace first and repair later is the rule. And the question of how many spares you have is determined by roughly your mean time to repair divided by your mean time between failures. But it's going to be important, right? Keep records of serial numbers swapped and replaced, right? So obviously you're going to want to know who's got which serial number. So there's two things that will happen, right? When you swap out a device, the serial number of the device that the student is holding will change, but then the one that you just took back in will eventually disappear and be replaced with a new one that's new to your inventory. So it's a wee bit of a wee thing you've got to keep in mind there, that there's two changes of serial number are going to happen, not just one. What I found really useful in recent times is having a complete log of all the incidents that happened and why they happened. So I look at the dates, which is how I know what our mean time between failures is. I look at the date, whose iPad it was, what the reasons were, and you know, whether I think it was, you know, accidental damage, deliberate damage, just device failure. And what that does is it will tell you, you know, is there some kind of systemic problem here? Such as if everything you're seeing back is a cracked screen with no explanation, then possibly you got a case that wasn't good enough, for example. And this, the other thing is, you know, you're going to want to keep a record of who was involved in case there's perhaps one person who's abusing their device. I mean, in a small school like yours and mine, Bradley, you'll probably know that intuitively, you know, this person drops their device all the time or whatever. But in a larger school, you may want to just formalize that a little bit and make sure that you track who's responsible for that. And also that's going to help with payment, which we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah, I think the overall thing there is document, document, document. I mean, we have great tools like Google Drive, Evernote, Dropbox that you could document all that stuff very easily.
Yep. And it's not that will be terribly useful at the time, but you come to the end of 3 years, you can look back and say, well, look what we achieved: 2% failure rate per year, 2% damage rate per year. And it's been really influential for me to be able to go to other schools and say to them, look, here are my numbers. From an actual real live iOS deployment, 2% failure, 2% damage per year over 3 years. Those are genuine numbers that we achieve. It's not just something I'm claiming to you that could happen. And that's really influential for people. It's great to be able to talk about that. And the last question, and sometimes possibly the thorniest question, is who's going to pay for this? Right? Because iPad repairs are not cheap anymore. I mentioned earlier, the prices have gone up. And in fact, you know, I was having this conversation today that you can buy a new Chromebook for less than the cost of an iPad repair. Not to put too fine a point on it. this is something, like, from a point of view of school management, right? This is something that you must be explicit about before it happens, right? So instead of kidding on to everybody that nothing will ever break, or the insurance will always pay for it or whatever, plan for damage and failure, because it'll happen, right? And then the point is, we have agreed that in this circumstance, somebody's going to pay, right? Either it's going to be the school is going to pay, or the parent is going to pay, or something in between. You know, again, the answer to that question depends on your school, right? If you feel like it's impossible that the parents would ever be able to afford to cough up for incidental damage repairs, then maybe there's a mechanism to do it through the school or through school insurance or something like that, or something in between. A lot of resellers now are pushing insurance as part of the product that they put together for you, and it's not just you're buying bare devices, but you're buying devices covered by an insurance and a warranty and a case and all that stuff for this one fixed price per pupil per month. So usually that's how most schools would deal with it, I think. But there's certainly flexibility to do it different ways there.
Well, and I know we've talked about some schools, you literally cannot ask parents to pay for anything. And you know, we know there are those situations, but you want to answer these questions before you hand them out and something's broken. And then you're trying to scramble to put together an acceptable use policy that no one's going to agree to. And try to eliminate as many gray areas as possible. You know, when you say things like, if we determine the student was negligent, then the parent may have to pay. Well, who determines that?
Yeah. That all of that kind of procedural stuff has to be written down in your AUP as well. And we actually have parents and students sign a document that says that they've read and agree to that part. And you know, to be fair, you know, we've had situations where people have broken their iPad and parents have been like, well, that's a hell of a lot of money, but I know we signed an agreement, so I'll pay it. You know. And they may not be happy about how much it is, but they at least recognize that we agreed before we started all this years ago that this was how it was going to go down if this situation ever arose that has arisen. You have to get that done beforehand. That's not something that can happen after. You're absolutely right, because suddenly it's like, oh, I'm altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further, sort of thing, you know, and that can put a lot of people's backs up in quite spectacular fashion.
Yeah, and can kind of sour the taste of how parents feel about your deployment.
Yeah. Particularly if you do something like get the wrong case or get no case or whatever. You know, I've seen schools where they're using like the smart cover, and my heart's just in my mouth every minute I'm looking at what's going on in those schools, just because, you know, the possibility of that thing falling off is so great. could hardly watch. And I suppose the final question, Bradley, just to wrap it up, is who do you get to do the repair? I mean, we've talked about Apple Store. You've mentioned having local people fix glass and things like that. Are you comfortable with doing that?
They're not. The glass isn't as good a quality, but mm-hmm. it's certainly cheap. It's cheaper if something is out of warranty than having to basically pay Apple to swap it. It's okay. The quality isn't great, and sometimes it's a hassle to, again, it takes a couple of days to get it back often, but it's, it's doable. And it seems like those shops are cropping up more and more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think, I know I made some mistakes in our first deployment where I was perhaps a little overzealous in getting things repaired, because the things being on a lease, I thought, well, we've got to hand back really nice devices, right? And in fact, you could hand them back with a fairly reasonable amount of damage on them, and the lease company would just eat that, but I think it does depend a little bit what stage you're at in your lease as well. If you have a failure in the first year and you're going to have to live with that repaired device for two more years, you may want to put the money into getting a legitimate repair at that point. Whereas if it's a month before the end of the last term, before you send them all away again, maybe you either just want to get a backstreet repair or you might not actually want to repair it at all. I had a couple of situations just towards the very end of our first lease where it was things like, the sleep-wake button wasn't working very well on a couple of kids' iPads. I said, look, it's May. We've only got, a month to go. I'm just going to show you how to use assistive touch for the last month, and then we're going to just get rid of this device. So the other thing to bear in mind is there are situations where you may not want to bother repairing it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I've had situations on trackpads where it doesn't click as well, and yeah. Especially towards the end of our last lease, and I just told the student, all right, we're just going to tap it on this one from here on out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's okay to modify, kind of usage of the device, especially towards the end.
Yeah, definitely. Unless, of course, your lease has requirements for handing them back in a certain condition. So if you take that, the sort of the operational lease models, it's called in the UK, I'm not sure what it's called in the US, Bradley, we've talked to this before, the sort of the one where you've got to pay the final residual value before you get a device, the opposite of your dollar buyout lease. Do we have a name for that?
Fair market value.
Fair market value, that's what you guys call it. You may have, there may be some conditions in the lease there where you have to turn all those devices in reasonable condition. So if you show up with five of broken home buttons and four with cracked screens, you may actually end up having to take a charge for that at the end. Now that charge may be less than the repair cost, right? So if you get five devices to repair at a cost of £250 each, you may want to talk to your finance people and say, well, look, I've got five cracked screens. How much is that going to cost me? And it may be, less than the full retail cost, the full repair cost. Okay. So let's wrap it up there, Bradley. I think that's been a good show. Let's just remind people where they can find us.
I'm on the web at chambersdaily.com and on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
I'm Fraser Spears on the web, Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web, and we will catch you guys next week.